Oh no, we are chained to a wall. Ah! This is going to mess up our geometry big time. Remember what Poincaré said. Self-motion is the essence of geometry. We understand that part of the environment to be geometrical that we can cancel through self-motion, through a change of perspective, so to speak. Suppose you're looking at a chair, for example, and somebody tips it over. Now the chair is laying on its side. Or perhaps somebody moves the chair to the other end of the room. Those are examples of geometrical transformations, rotations, and displacements in space. They are the equivalence relations of space, the isometries, as we say, things that you can do without changing metric relationships. And you know that these are geometrical equivalence transformations because you can cancel them through self-motion. When the guy knocks the chair over, you can tilt your head 90 degrees and you have restored the original visual impression of the chair. And if the guy moves the chair 5 meters that way, you yourself can move 5 meters in the same direction. And once again, the chair makes precisely the same visual impression on your retina as it did before. This is how you know that rotations and displacements are geometrical equivalence transformations. The more you accumulate experience with these kinds of scenarios, the more you begin to grasp the group of geometrical transformations as a whole. You get the global sense of what kinds of transformations are possible and how they combine and interact and compose one followed by the other and so on. So this process might lead you to Euclidean geometry or non-Euclidean conceptions of space depending on your experiences, depending on which kinds of transformations exist and how they behave. You get to know space. You get to know what kind of geometry space has by getting to know the transformation group of the space. That is to say, what kinds of rotations and displacements and those kinds of things exist and what happens when you do one after the other and so on. That's geometry. Now, what happens when we are chained to the wall? We must imagine we've been chained to this wall forever. We don't know any other reality than this. In this scenario, our sense of what geometrical transformations are possible, which kinds of transformations exist, it will be very different than they were for a free-moving person. There's still geometry, though. There are still visual impressions that we can cancel through self-motion. For example, if an object is moving across our field of view, we can keep the retinal impressions of that object the same by tracking the motion of the object with a motion of our eyes. So therefore, we understand the geometry of sideways motion very well. We understand motion across our field of view. And because we can move our eyes from left to right, and we can point our gaze in different directions and thereby canceling the motion of objects, so we will have a kind of geometry still, a visual field of geometry in Poincaré's sense. And furthermore, we can also understand the geometry of depth even. When we are stuck to the wall, if an object is moving away from us, we can keep track of that through self-motion as well. A very different kind of self-motion, though, because not looking from side to side, but rather we can do this using the lens in the eye. The eye has a lens that concentrates the rays of light. It has variable curvature. It is controlled by a muscle. Depending on whether you need to focus on objects that are near or far, you look at something in the distance or something close to you, then based on that, the eye will adapt by using muscles to pinch or pull the lens in the eye so that it's more round or more flat so that it has the right focal distance for the object that you're looking at. And based on this, you can keep track of how much an object has moved in depth by recording how much the lens needs to be adjusted to restore focus if the object moved in the depth dimension. So that gives you the data to develop a geometry of depth. And it is a kind of self-motion because it is the muscle that under your own control, even though it's subconscious for us in everyday experience. Nevertheless, it is in principle, the mind has access and control of the behavior of these muscles that govern the lens in the eye. So therefore, these chains that kept us locked up, still, they do not deprive us of geometry altogether, however. We can still develop the geometry of width, based on moving our eye sideways, and depth, based on our lens analysis. These are, however, separate geometries to us in this situation. The free person will know width and depth, that's two dimensions of the same kind of thing. And they are both spatial dimensions, they're interchangeable, they are homogeneous. The free person knows this because they can turn width into depth through self-motion. They just need to go stand over there and look the other way, and then what used to be width has now become depth and the other way around. So obviously those are equivalent. We who are chained to the wall, we are deprived of this experience. To us, width and depth are qualitatively different kinds of things. Indeed, we would measure distance in width and distance in depth with completely different units. We could count distance in width, the direction, that has to do with the direction in which our eyes are pointing. The unit is for maybe degrees, let's say. An object is 30 degrees to the left of another, for example, those kinds of things. That's how we might quantify that. But the way we count depth, that is by how much the lens needs to be bent to achieve focus. The unit is something like a unit of force, for example, corresponding to the muscular effort involved in how the lens needs to be manipulated. So that's a completely different kind of thing altogether, two different units for the two different dimensions. We cannot compare our degree measurements that we use to quantify position in width with the force measurements that we use to quantify position in depth. Well, maybe that's not so strange to imagine, you know. Width and depth could be qualitatively different. Why not? You are already used to many different kinds of measurements being qualitatively different, obviously, in everyday life. For example, suppose somebody asked you, is this building wider than it is old? Well, of course, that doesn't make any sense. You cannot compare a distance in space with a duration in time. Those are qualities that are determined in fundamentally different kinds of ways. They are measured in completely different kinds of units, and so on. So, just as you think time and space are not comparable, so the person who is chained to the wall believes that depth and width are not comparable. Well, samesies. In fact, maybe you are just as delusional as the chained guy for much the same reason. Actually, time and space are a lot more comparable and interchangeable than you think. That is what Einstein's theory of relativity says. We don't realize this in our everyday life, in our everyday experience, because the relativistic effects become significant only at very high speeds, somewhat close to the speed of light. And compared to the speed of light, you've been practically standing still your entire life, even when you're flooring it on the highway or whatever. So you might as well have been chained to a wall, really, compared to the speed of light. You're practically standing still. The sum total of all your visual sensory impressions are severely, systematically impoverished, just like the guy who's stuck to the wall. Just as he doesn't realize the fundamental unity of width and depth, so you don't realize the fundamental unity of time and space. And for the same reason, you're both essentially standing still. I took this example, by the way, from Feynman's famous lectures on physics, this example with the person chained to the wall. You know, why don't we listen to his version as well, the classic Feynman lectures on physics. They are nowadays available for free. Caltech website, audio recordings and all. So here we go. Feynman explaining this fascinating way to think about relativity theory through this analogy.
If it were impossible to ever move and to always see the same object in the same position, this whole business would be irrelevant. I'd always see the widths and the depths, and they would have such a different quality for me, because one is an apparent optical angle, and the other one is a more difficult to get at, involves the focusing of the eyes or an intuition. So they're very different things, and they would never get mixed up. But because I can walk around, I realize that depth and width are just two different aspects of somehow or other the same thing. Can we not look at the Lorentz transformations the same way? There is a mixture between the positions and the time, a mixture between a space measurement and a time measurement, to produce a new space measurement. In other words, in the space measurement of one man, there's some kind of a little bit of the time as seen from the other. But our brains do not immediately recalculate when we start moving at high speed, because we have no effective experience but going nearly at the speed of light to appreciate the fact that the time and the space are also of the same nature. It's as though we were always stuck in the position of having to look at the width of something and not being able to move our head appreciably one way or the other.
So, yeah, that's great stuff. I love this thought experiment there with this chained guy. Plato's K2.0, so to speak. This thought experiment is perfect for our purposes today. It's going to be the concluding episode of my History, Philosophy of Geometry story arc. And the theme will be everything going full circle. The beautiful ideas from days of old are as relevant as ever to us self-absorbed moderns also. And the guy who's chained to a wall, it is a perfect backward-looking example, as well as a perfect forward-looking example. It looks back to the operationalism of Greek geometry. It looks forward to Einsteinian modernity. So we started way back when, if you recall, with the Greeks and their ubiquitous ruler and compass. Always with the making, those guys. Lines and circles are nothing but what you get when you draw with these tools, the ruler and the compass. They're not abstract things. They're not axiomatically defined things. Lines and circles are operations. They're things you do. The Greeks, they realized that this was the rigorous way to do mathematics. The epistemological humility of the maker is far superior to the hubris of the philosopher who thinks that they can concoct a perfect theoretical system in the abstract, using the power of the mind alone. People are not as good as that as they think. Time and time again, somebody's pretentious abstract theory has proven to contain various unintended contradictions and unnoticed assumptions, as the Greeks knew all too well. You know, the works of Plato and Aristotle, they do little else than to poke holes in other people's bad theories and prove that the unintended assumptions are hidden beneath the surface. So we should stop trying to philosophize about essences, which we're so bad at, and instead we should roll up our sleeves and build stuff. Clear the junk off the table in your garage, put your tool belt on, and let's double some cubes. This is the spirit of Greek mathematics. To know is to do. This principle runs all the way through history. In physics, we can only know relative space, not absolute space, like as Descartes and Leibniz said. Because we can measure distances between things, but we cannot measure any such thing as the absolute coordinates of any one thing in itself without reference to other reference points. So, if we believe in the virtue of the humble maker and the hubris of the speculative philosopher, then it follows that we must base our physics on relative space, not on absolute space. A very reasonable conclusion, which Newton abandoned to the dismay of many at the time. So, if we stick to the classical point of view, then space is what you can make and what you can measure and what you can experience, in other words. It's a good philosophy of space. No wonder the Greeks, Descartes, Leibniz. Back then, mathematical and philosophical sophistication went hand in hand to a rare degree, so it is no wonder that they had some good idea, those guys. But don't take my word for it. What makes a philosophy good anyway? Not to say so, some podcaster, that's for sure. But we can prove that the classical operationalist perspective was good philosophy by considering how it fared in the face of entirely new developments. You know, bad philosophy is always backpedaling. As soon as new facts come in, you have to go, what I meant was, and you come up with some story. Or bad philosophy is also descriptive, you know. Some people think they have a philosophy of something when you're just describing its basic features and they're making up a name for each part, just sticking labels on things. That's not philosophy. Good philosophy is not like that. Good philosophy is a perspective that makes you think in new ways. It gives you tools that you can use to try to understand conceptually challenging new problems. Philosophy is good if it's a fruitful way to think in challenging new situations, such as non-Euclidean geometry, for example, the rather counterintuitive new world. We could really use some philosophy to find our feet in here. And which philosophy is going to help us, do you think? Well, maybe Aristotle's four different names for four different kinds of causes, you know? Yeah, right. However, thinking of space and geometry in terms of operations, now that's a philosophy, and it will prove its worth by the way that it interacts with these new developments. How do we know whether we live in a Euclidean space or a hyperbolic space? Look, not by developing these two geometries abstractly and axiomatically and then testing them by anglesome theorems or whatever. No, thank you. That would be that hubristic assumption again, you know, that we can develop geometry purely in the abstract, in the mind alone. Geometry needs to come from experience. But how? In fact, modern mathematics has told us exactly how this is going to work. A geometry is defined by its group of equivalence transformations, as Felix Klein said in his famous Erlanger program. And a group of equivalence transformations can be defined in turn in terms of experience. That's precisely what Poincaré told us. Equivalence transformations are the transformations you can cancel through self-motion. Perfect. It all fits together. In this way, the difference between Euclidean and hyperbolic geometry emerges organically from experience itself. And there is no need to postulate the hubristic ability of the human mind to develop axiomatic systems in the abstract. Later, we can go on to do more conventional abstract axiomatic mathematics as well, of course, from this point of view. But if so, we would do that by building on the concrete substrate that we have developed through this intuition of from experience in the manner of Poincaré. We are not born with general purpose abstract reasoning skills, according to this perspective. We have domain-specific innate abilities, such as the ability to acquire geometry by extracting a group of equivalence transformations of space, that the space we live in, from sensory experience based on self-motion. And insofar as we eventually succeed in general abstract reasoning or conventional mathematics, so to speak, if we succeed at that, that is because we have mobilized our domain-specific skills and domain-specific modes of thought to simulate abstract general-purpose thought. Well, that's one perspective that I associated with Poincaré and Chomsky, for example, if you recall. And the person who is chained to a wall is an example that can be used to illustrate this entire tradition that goes all the way back to the Greeks, indeed. To restrict the operations that a guy can perform, and you restrict his geometry. I think perhaps Feynman didn't realize this stuff, that his example has this kind of historical roots of sorts, this thought experiment. It can be related to a long philosophical tradition, indeed. But Feynman, maybe he came up with this thought experiment, I guess, himself, or far as I know. And you could imagine that maybe he came up with it by starting with Einstein's relativity theory, and he asked himself, you know, how can I illustrate this counterintuitive conception of time and space using an analogy? And then the idea that the concept of physical theory that depends on the kinds of experience that one has or the kinds of measurements that one can make, it comes off looking like, a quirky side effect of relativity theory, you know, rather than a methodological axiom that's actually built in from the very beginning. Indeed, it's an axiom that was strongly established before relativity theory was even conceived, and Einstein was well aware of this tradition, in fact, and purposefully created relativity theory thinking in these kinds of terms. So Feynman perhaps didn't look at it that way. Maybe he looked at it sort of the science comes first and then you sort of recreate a sort of philosophical story that can explain the science after the fact. Maybe because we can listen to another remark that Feynman made that in a different lecture, which does seem to point in this kind of direction. So let's listen to this passage here, and we want to think about what causes what, you know, what comes first, the physics or the philosophy.
One of the consequences of this business in relativity was the development of a philosophy which said you should only define what you can measure. And since it's self-evident that you can't define or measure the velocity without looking at what you're measuring it relative to, therefore it was clear that there was no meaning to absolute velocity. And that the physicists should have appreciated that they can only talk about what they can measure.
One could argue that it was the other way around. This way of thinking, it's not a consequence of relativity theory, as Feynman says.
One of the consequences.
If anything, you could argue it is relativity theory that is the consequence, in fact, of this philosophical point of view.
The physicists should have appreciated that they can only talk about what they can measure.
Yes, very true. They should have appreciated that, and they did. They did so thousands of years before Einstein. They didn't learn it from relativity theory. They had already known this for thousands of years. And indeed, Einstein himself did read a lot of that stuff in his youth, including Ernst Mach, Poincaré. Einstein made no secret that he had read those things and that they influenced him greatly. Relativity theory, it was a philosophy-driven scientific development to an unusual degree. Without Poincaré's beautiful philosophy of space, no Einstein, perhaps. Feynman thought the guy chained to a wall, it was a perfect thought experiment to describe Einstein's theory. Yes, it is, but it is an equally perfect thought experiment to describe Poincaré's philosophy of space, which came before Einstein's theory. Certainly Feynman was right as well, of course, when he said that the success of Einstein's theory did lead to those operationalist philosophical conclusions. It did indeed, but not because science developed in its own autonomous technical way, and then after the fact some people asked themselves, I wonder if you can draw some philosophical conclusions from this new science. It wasn't like that, you know. It was a revival of old philosophy rather than a new start stimulated by new science. So Einstein's theory didn't so much rectify the course of philosophy as much as it showed that the philosophers had actually been right all along, quite embarrassingly, in fact. Remember how Newton's absolute space was criticized by Leibniz, for example, as well as others at the time. Only relative space makes epistemological sense. Only relative space is knowable, because only relative space is measurable, or in other words, only relative space can be operationalized. Operationalization is the way to ensure consistency, as the classical constructivist tradition in geometry knew. There are two ways to introduce objects in mathematics: by construction or by wishlist to Santa Claus. Let ABC be the figure you get when you dot dot dot. This is how you introduce objects by construction. First, I raise this perpendicular to that line. Then I cut off a length here that is equal to this length over there. Then I connect that point and that point, and so on. That is the honest way to do things, by recipe. The object is defined by the recipe for making it. An object is nothing but the outcome of operations that you perform yourself. The other way to introduce a mathematical object is lazier and easier. Let ABC be a figure such that so and so and so. That is the wish list to Santa Claus. You state what it is that you want. Let ABC be an equilateral triangle. Let ABC be a triangle with three right angles. Let me have a flying car and a unicorn pony. You state the properties that you want an object to have, and like a spoiled child, you assume that you are thereby entitled to the object in question. Newton was like a spoiled child asking for a unicorn. His new physics demanded absolute space and time, which were merely postulated or wish-listed, you might say, and then it cannot be operationalized. People like Leibniz therefore objected very reasonably. Newton's physics is built on concepts that are unknowable, and it is exposed to the risk of containing inconsistencies and contradictions because it is not susceptible to operationalization, which has been the best way to ensure consistency since the days of Euclid. There are no unicorn ponies. There are no triangles with three right angles. But a spoiled child wouldn't know that, would he? Because he is not constrained by what is actually doable. That's the danger of doing wish list science. Maybe Newton's physics, therefore, is ultimately incoherent, since it has not taken steps to ensure its own consistency, which we would do through operationalization. This critique of Newton was philosophically perfectly sound. However, it soon looked absolutely ridiculous. Newton's physics was a runaway success like the world has never seen. And then you had these ridiculous little philosophers going, well, actually, that's actually bad science because blah, 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 blah. You know, who would listen to those clueless nitpicks, you know? Read the room, nerds. Newton has already won. Nobody cares about your stupid, well, actually. Let me quote to you David Hume, for example. David Hume, he was one of those philosophy losers in the 18th century. And here are his words. A notion beyond that, what we have instruments and art to make, is a mere fiction of the mind and useless as well as incomprehensible. That is, those are David Hume's words. And for example, the concept of absolute space fits that description indeed. We have no instruments and art, that is to say, we have no physical experiments or observations that can detect absolute space. Therefore, the notion of absolute space is a useless fiction of the mind, according to David Hume's criteria. You know, quite so, and here's another passage where Hume says the same thing. When we entertain, therefore, any suspicion that the philosophical term is employed without any meaning or idea, as is but too frequent, we need but inquire, from what impression is that supposed idea derived? And if it be impossible to assign any, this will serve to confirm our suspicion. So, that those are Hume's word, and indeed we cannot assign sensory impressions to the notion of absolute space, so therefore the term is employed without any meaning, as Hume puts it. So Hume even explains also why we should insist on this criterion of meaning. Here are his words about that. If we carry our inquiry beyond the appearances of objects to the senses, I am afraid that most of our conclusions will be full of skepticism and uncertainty. And meanwhile, as long as we confine our speculations to the appearances of objects to our senses, we are safe from all difficulties and can never be embarrassed by any question. So that means, I take it, that we can never run into any self-contradictions that stem from fictions of the mind. To be embarrassed, as Hume says, that is to have contradictions in your thinking exposed to you. You know, just stick to the senses, stick to what we have instruments and art to make, and then you will be fine. You will never be embarrassed. You will never run into contradiction. So those are the words of David Hume. You know, I kind of hate David Hume, honestly. He is the Galileo of philosophy, an overrated false idol who erroneously gets credit for trivial ideas that had long been obvious to mathematically and scientifically competent people. So the quotes I just read from Hume, yes, fine philosophy, you know, or rather, they were fine philosophy 100 years before Hume, when the same ideas were advocated by better philosophers. I have argued that these notions that I just described, they were already well known to Greek mathematicians for that matter, but, well, anyway, we can't prove that, you know. We don't have the source evidence to know for sure one way or the other what the Greek mathematicians thought about such things. But in any case, those ideas that I quoted from Hume, they were in any case well understood by Descartes and Leibniz, for instance, the century before Hume, and which is why they insisted that all geometry must be constructive. And it's also why they insisted that only relative space makes any philosophical sense. Absolute space is a cardinal sin that must be banished from the face of the earth. But look, when Descartes and Leibniz said those things, they were scientifically viable ideas. Descartes and Leibniz put their money where their mouth was. They backed up their philosophy with detailed technical scientific works that contained both technical progress on advanced mathematical problems, as well as a programmatic vision for how scientific and mathematical practice can move forward in harmony with philosophical and epistemological principles. After Newton, that dream is dead. Philosophy lost. All scientifically competent people knew as much. Therefore, only the scientifically ignorant, such as David Hume, kept beating this dead horse. As one historian has put it, David Hume was a dour scientific dilettante with almost unparalleled ignorance of the science of his day. Love that quote. So, indeed, in the 18th century, only people like that could still defend this old philosophy. People with scientific integrity, they knew that they could not in good conscience advocate for that kind of philosophy anymore, because then they would have to give a philosophically coherent physics that worked as well as Newton's absolute space-based physics, but avoided its philosophical pitfalls. Well, nobody could do that. Nobody could come up with that alternative, a philosophically coherent alternative to Newton. So, therefore, the only people who could still repeat these old philosophies that were no longer scientifically credible were now, in the 18th century, the scientifically airheaded people like David Hume, who wouldn't have known good mathematics if it hit him in the face. That was the sad state of this once proud philosophy in the 18th century. No wonder that this anti-Newtonian philosophy became a laughingstock. And then, plot twist. They were right. Einstein's theory exactly vindicates what these people have been saying for more than 200 years. If you try to do science with Newton's Santa Claus concept of space and time, you are doomed to run into inconsistencies, exactly as these guys have been warning. And the way out of these hopeless inconsistencies is operationalize everything. Exactly what these philosophy nerds have been saying all along. It's unbelievable. Imagine insisting that the most successful scientific theory of all time that has proved itself again and again for centuries is bound to lead to inconsistencies and self-contradictions. So any day now, you know, that must be one of the dumbest predictions of all time, you would think. What stubborn and oblivious people will keep embarrassing themselves by making those silly criticisms to insist on their philosophy to such an extent that they keep at it with this when they have obviously lost. And then Those guys, those very archetypes of the utter irrelevance and pointlessness of philosophy, those guys of old people, they hit the cleanest home run you will ever see with Einstein's relativity theory. That's exactly, they could not have asked for anything more perfect to vindicate their points. Insane. Anyway, we have to do some relativity theory here in order to show this, to illustrate concretely what I mean when I say that Einstein's relativity theory is a perfect fit for this old philosophy. All right, let's see, let's set the stage. Oh, we're on a cruise ship. Wow, amazing. The atmosphere here is incredible. Let's go below deck. Look, there's a tennis court over here. Oh boy, tennis is fun. Time flies, though. While we've been playing tennis, you know, has the ship reached the destination and anchored in port, or are we still moving? You can't tell. That's the principle of relativity theory. Everything in the tennis room is the same, whether the ship is moving at a constant speed or standing still. So even though one of us is playing perhaps with the direction of travel and the other is playing against the direction which the ship is going, that doesn't mean that the serves and smashes will be boosted one way and slow down the other. And if we hit equal serves at the same time, they will reach the net in the center of the court at exactly the same time. The one that was going forward is at the same time as the one that was going backward, so to speak, with respect to the motion of the ship. So that feels very natural to us in the room. We are so absorbed in the game, we are not paying attention to whether the ship is moving or not. We are using the room that we're in as a frame of reference or our coordinate system, so to speak. That is the center of our universe at the moment when we are absorbed in our tennis match. For instance, let's say that we can hit tennis serves going 50 meters per second and it's about 12.5 meters to the net. Then it will take a quarter second for the serve to get to reach the net. That's the science of tennis that is relevant to us when we are absorbed in the game. It's not, however, the ship is traveling at such so many knots or whatever. That doesn't matter. It's not relevant for us because we are using the room as a reference frame. But the same thing also works if it's seen from the outside. So there's some guy standing on the shore, he's watching us go by. And he's a science nerd. It turns out he happens to have one of those speed cameras, you know, that the police use to catch cars going about the speed limits and stuff. So he's making these measurements, keeping track of speeds of things. And according to him, the ship is going 10 meters per second. And he also measures the speed of our tennis serves somehow. And they were 50 meters per second, according to ourselves. However, that's not what this guy will detect, what the readings on his camera will say. Because velocities will behave additively, and the speed of a projectile will be the speed at which the projector is moving plus the firing speed. So if I am serving with the direction of the ship, in the direction of travel, then the serve will go 10 plus 50 meters per second. So the speed of the ship plus the speed of the serve itself. 60, that is what the speed measured by the observer on the shore with his speed camera. So the serve going the other way, it will have the velocity 10 minus 50, 40 meters per second in the opposite direction. So according to those values, that means that that person, the outsider, the person on the shore, disagrees with us about the speeds. We had a different conception of speed with our reference frame, but he has a different. Nevertheless, he agrees with us that the two tennis serves will reach the net in the middle of the court at the same time, simultaneously. And that makes sense from his point of view. He has a different explanation for why you get that phenomenon, you know. But we both agree that that's going to happen. But his explanation for why that is going to happen has to do with the takes into account the motion of the ship. The tennis serve, that is the faster one, that one that goes with its own speed plus the speed of the ship, that has further to go because the net has moved away from its starting position while the ball is in the air. So if it took a quarter second for the serve to reach the net we calculated, then in that time the ship will have moved 2.5 meters because it went 10 meters per second. So the 60 meters per second serve will have 12.5 plus 2.5 meters to go, so 15 meters in total because the net will have moved in the meanwhile. And the slower serve, which went 40 meters per second, it has the net coming toward it, so it only has to go 12.5 minus 2.5 meters, so that's 10 meters. So, indeed, going 15 meters at the speed of 60, it takes the same amount of time as going 10 meters at the speed of 40. So, indeed, the fact that the motion of the ship is undetectable to us inside the room is basically equivalent to the principle of the additivity of velocities as seen from some other fixed vantage point. So, yes, that's very boring. It's high school physics, you know, who cares about that trivial rubbish? Well, it's not so trivial, actually. In fact, it's wrong, and it is inconsistent with other parts of physics, as we shall see. So so-called trivial things can turn out to be quite profound. We remember this from Euclid, for example. Actually, it will turn out to be analogous to this example here. So you may recall, for instance, the construction of a square from Euclid's Elements, Proposition 46. At first sight, you might say, oh, well, what a big commotion about nothing, you know. I guess Euclid wrote for kids in middle school or something, you know. Obviously a research mathematician doesn't need to have squares explained to them step by step. That's silly and trivial and ridiculous, isn't it? You know, you may have thought that, but you would have been wrong. In fact, there are no squares in spherical geometry or hyperbolic geometry. Therefore, carefully tracking the fundamental assumptions on which the existence of squares is based, that is a deep theoretical question. And Euclid knew that. He didn't write for middle schoolers. He wrote for highly sophisticated mathematicians who had thought a lot about the foundations of geometry. And it's the same in the case with the so-called trivial physics in the tennis room. So let's see how we can reanalyze this so-called trivial situation in operationalist terms. Let two tennis balls be fired at the same time. Oh no, that's not permissible. That's like saying, let ABCD be a square. We can't have that kind of nonsense. We have to operationalize. This is what we have learned in geometry, and that is what will be our guiding principle here in physics as well. That was all very easy with Newton's absolute time, unicorn time. Yeah, sure, if that universal absolute time is given to you by Santa Claus, then the tennis players, they can just use that to coordinate their serves. Ah, problem solvers. No, there's no... The concept of let's serve at the same time, it becomes a triviality. However, if we don't want to rely on Santa Claus, we have to coordinate the tennis serves ourselves instead of saying let it be. So how should we do that? Well, okay, maybe I'll count it off, you know, 1, 2, 3, go. And then we both serve at the same time, we both go and go. No, not really, because I will hear the word go when I say it, when you have to wait a little bit because the sound takes a certain amount of time to travel across the room and you're standing over there and you can. So we're not really synchronized that way at all with the 1, 2, 3, go method. It's the same with any other signal-based coordination. Light signals, for example, there's this like a little green light that goes on and then we both serve at the same time or whatever. Or we both look at the clock on the scoreboard next to the tennis court or whatever. You know, the speed of light is not instantaneous either, so all of those kinds of situations, it's going to matter how far the signal had to travel, whether we are one of us is closer to the signal source than the other, and stuff like that. So it gets complicated. So now, if we think that it all has to do with how far we are from the source, where the signal is coming from, then it seems that the definition of same time becomes dependent on the concept of distance, equal distances. And indeed, that is also something that Einstein sort of embraces. He does indeed make his concept of simultaneity depend on the concept of distance. And I will quote to you here from his book. It is called his 1916 book. The English title is Relativity, Special and General Theory. This is Einstein's popularized presentation of his relativity theory, and basically it's an expanded, explained version of what he says in his famous 1905 paper on special relativity. So you can also read it there if you want in more compact form in the research paper. But, well, anyway, this is his kind of semi-popularized. In any case, I'm quoting now from Einstein's 1916 book. We require a definition of simultaneity, such that this definition supplies us with the method by means of which we can decide by experiment whether or not two events occur simultaneously. As long as this requirement is not satisfied, I allow myself to be deceived when I imagine that I am able to attach meaning to the statement of simultaneity. So, yes, great. Indeed, we can't just say, look, we both checked our iPhones and it's at the same time, so it was simultaneous, you know. Who gave you those iPhones anyway, right? Santa Claus again. Look, we need a do-it-yourself option. That's what Einstein is going to provide, like just like he said. And here I quote now the definition that he offers. Quote, we offer the following suggestion with which to test simultaneity of two events, one occurring at point A and the other at point B. The connecting line AB should be measured up, and an observer should be placed at the midpoint M of the distance AB. This observer should be supplied with an arrangement such as two mirrors, which allows him to visually observe both places A and B at the same time. If the observer perceives the two flashes of lightning at the same time, then they are simultaneous. So, there you go. That's the operational definition of what it means for two things to happen at the same time. It is interesting that this is operationalization of simultaneity involves finding the midpoint of the line segment that connects the two locations where the two lightning flashes or whatever events took place. Einstein, he didn't need to explain any further that part about the finding the midpoint, because that was already operationalized by Euclid, you know, if you recall, proposition 10 of the Euclid's Elements there, to find the midpoint of a given line segment. So, well, kind of funny how these guys are in continuity, and that goes a lot beyond finding midpoints, as I shall explain. Anyway, so we have Einstein's definition of simultaneity then, what it means for two things to happen at the same time. It is in the spirit of the operationalist tradition, it's the kind of physics advocated by Descartes and Leibniz. As we have seen, fundamental physical notions, they need to be formulated in terms that show how they are knowable, such as simultaneity being knowable or accessible to observation by defining it in terms of looking at two events by means of mirrors and seeing whether or not they coincide observationally in the same moment in time. So if it's just about tennis and such phenomenon, then all this stuff doesn't really matter. And indeed, that is why this way of doing physics, the Leibniz-Descartes way of doing physics, it didn't really go anywhere for 200 years. People just used Newton's Santa Claus time, and so they didn't have to worry about any of that stuff with the mirrors and whatever, how to make it observational. Absolute time is a God-given thing, just go with it. That was the spirit of Newton, and that it worked, so nobody bothered, you know, to question that. Now, the philosophical subtleties about what simultaneity means become relevant, however, when we're dealing with speeds comparable to the speed of light, which is, you know, the relativity theory is all about stuff comparable to the speed of light. That's when things get weird. So the speed of light does not behave additively, unlike the tennis balls. If I'm standing on a moving ship and I fire a tennis ball forwards, then I add speed to the ball in addition to the speed that it already had for moving along with the ship to begin with. But however, if I turn on a flashlight, I point it in the direction in which the ship is going, you know, it doesn't get extra speed on top of the speed that the flashlight was already going at. Rather, it will just go the speed of light, a natural constant, regardless of however I was traveling. So it's not the speed at which was already going plus the new speed, you know, that it's always the same speed of light, regardless of whether you are going with or against the motion of the ship and so on. So light behaves this way. That can be seen experimentally. It was something that was discovered not long before Einstein's theory and the constancy of the speed of light. Experimental fact, but it's also a theoretical, important, embedded fact. Maxwell's equations of electromagnetism, you know, everybody studies still to this day, fundamental in a cornerstone of physics ever since they were discovered in the mid-19th century. And indeed, as Maxwell himself said, light is an electromagnetic disturbance propagated in the same medium through which other electromagnetic actions are transmitted. So light is the same kind of thing as the Wi-Fi signal for your phone and so on. So that was kind of makes all this stuff about light kind of is entangled with physical theory. And, you know, indeed, that Maxwell's claim was a discovery and not an assumption that he made, but a kind of empirical discovery, as it were, in a certain sense. And let me read to you Maxwell's personal description about that that discovery. Here's what he says. I made out the equations in the country before I had any suspicion of the nearness between the two values of the velocity of propagation of magnetic effects and that of light. So that's a quote that embodies this idea that he didn't build it into his theory, but he tested it, this prediction, or he tested whether that light agrees with the theory that he developed for electromagnetic things. So he developed his theory in the country, as he says in the quote, that is to say, in the rural family estate in the Scottish countryside. So he'd worked in isolation there. In other words, he didn't have access to books or labs or anything. So only later was he able to test the theory that he worked out in the country against laboratory data and whatever in the library. So the fact that light can be absorbed into the theory of electromagnetism, it was not an assumption built into the theory. It was something that could be independently confirmed later when Maxwell returned from the country. So for our purposes here, the point I'm making is that the constancy of the speed of light, it wasn't just an isolated experimental fact. It was a result intertwined with core physical theory already before Einstein. So indeed, the title of Einstein's famous 1905 paper, the special relativity paper, is on the electrodynamics of moving bodies. It's called, it refers to electrodynamics. So for precisely this reason that I mentioned, because it's all embedded with Maxwell's theory, etc. So anyway, the point is, it's not so strange then to give the constancy of the speed of light a big role in operationalizing time and space. So this axiom that the speed of light is constant, it is indeed effectively built into Einstein's definition of simultaneity. It takes light equal time to travel equal distances. If the speed of a light ray would depend on the speed of the object it was coming from, then Einstein's definition of simultaneity wouldn't make a lot of sense anymore. But precisely because the speed of light is constant, that means that we can count on equal distances and equal time, which is precisely what the definition says. If equal distances correspond to equal times, that is what the that is the principle built into the definition of simultaneity. So, very well. So throwing this new ingredient into the mix, though, it seems to ruin all that stuff we said before, all the tennis stuff, you know, because we already saw that the principle of relativity, that is to say the principle that we can't tell from inside a tennis room whether or not we're moving by using experiments or measuring the speeds of tennis serves or whatever, we can't tell if we're moving. That principle we saw went hand in hand with the principle of the additivity of speeds, because it was the additivity principle that made the calculations come out equivalently for a difference of servers, like the guy on the shore, for example. So that's what made it all work. When you switch perspectives, there are no more contradictions. You still agree that the two tennis servers reach the net at the same time and so on. However, if the speed of light doesn't behave additively, well, then shouldn't that mean that all that stuff would break down and then relativity would fall also, you would think. So we should be able to exploit the constancy of the speed of light to detect the motion of the ship from inside the tennis room. So precisely what we agree was impossible using tennis balls, it should be possible actually using light, which behaves completely differently than according to this rule. I mean, it's easy to imagine an experiment that would solve that would exploit the property to detect motion. You know, you and I, we stand at the opposite ends of the tennis court, we each have a flashlight, we turn on our flashlights at the same time, we see which light ray reached the net in the middle of the tennis court first. We just put a detector there. And you know, so the speed of light is a universal constant regardless of whether it was fired with or against the ship's motion, you know. So therefore, the two light rays will take a different amount of time to get to the net, because the net will have traveled whatever number of millimeters along with the ship while the light rays were on their way, while the light rays were in the air. So the principle of relativity is false. It is, in fact, detectable by a physical experiment from within the room then, whether the ship is moving or not. By using light set up, we can detect whether we're moving or standing. Right? No, that's not correct. And that is precisely an example of how these naive assumptions of Newtonian physics leads you to errors and to inconsistencies. You know, we turn on our flashlights at the same time, I said. Well, you should have stopped me right there, you know, warning bells go off. You know, I was thinking like a Newtonian, same time according to the absolute time given to us by Santa Claus. There is no such thing. You can't just say, let these things be done at the same time. It's precisely by operationalizing the concept of time that we see how naive this Newtonian Santa Claus perspective it really is. From the perspective of Newtonian absolute time, either the light rays were fired at the same time or not, and either they reached a net in the middle of the court at the same time or not, because of absolute time. These are just straightforward raw facts, as it were, and they are two independent facts, fired at the same time versus reaches the goal at the same time. Two separate things, and makes sense to test experimentally whether or not those things are coordinated or not. However, when we operationalize, we see how naive we have been when we gave that analysis. As we saw above, when we followed Einstein, the only way we could define the concept of two things happening at the same time operationally was to say the events happen at the same time. If the light signals from the event coincide when they reach the midpoint between the two locations which the events occurred. So we cannot independently check whether two light rays fired at the same time will reach the midpoint at the same time or not. If they reach the midpoint at the same time, then they were fired at the same time by definition. If they don't reach the midpoint at the same time, then they were not fired at the same time by definition. So with the humble and honest operational notion of time, that is all that we can conclude from those kinds of experiments. So the principle of relativity remains valid after all. There is no experiment that we can do inside a tennis room that shows us whether or not the ship is really moving. We see that when we think operationally, despite the fact that light does not behave additively, which we thought was equivalent to the principle of relativity before, when we were thinking classically in terms of Newtonian absolute time. Well, if that's true then, but how are you supposed to square that with the outside observer, the guy on the shore? You know, when we compare these two perspectives classically, it was the additivity of speeds that made everything work. You know, the speed of the ship plus the speed of the tennis serve. That's how we could make it all fit. And now we don't have additivity of velocities anymore because we're dealing with light. So, well, what then? How are you supposed to explain this from the outside perspective? From the perspective inside the room, we fire two light rays and they hit the midpoint at the same time. So therefore we concluded, they must have been fired simultaneously by definition. That's the only way we are able to define the concept of simultaneity operationally. So the guy on the outside of the ship who's looking at the same thing taking place, and he's going to come to a very different conclusion. He will have a different opinion about where the midpoint is located between the two firing positions at the two ends of opposite ends of the tennis court. To us on the ship, the midpoint is the net in the middle of the court. But the guy on the shore, he thinks the net is moving. He doesn't think you should use that as a reference point because it's a moving reference point. He will put his finger at a point that's stationary in space with respect to the shore, and that's the point that he wants to use to judge simultaneity. When that's the point which, you know, initially it is at a certain moment in time, it coincides with the net, but then since the net moves along with the ship, those two things are not, they're ultimately not the same point by the time the light gets there. So because of this, the events that are simultaneous as seen from inside the ship, they're not simultaneous according to a guy from the outside, because with the net in the middle of the court as the reference point, the light rays arrived at the same time. So by definition, they were fired simultaneously. That was the point of view inside the ship. However, if the light rays reach that point, the net point, at exactly the same moment, then they cannot also reach the other different reference point selected by outside observer also at the same moment. In fact, they must have reached that guy's reference point at different points in time, different moments. And therefore, by definition, they must have been fired at different times, according to him, not simultaneously, according to the outside observer's point of view. So when time is defined operationally, time is different according to different observers. There is no God-given absolute time that tells you whether or not two events really happen at the same time or not. One observer says one thing, another observer says something else. there is no way to decide who is right. So if you're reading along in Einstein's book that I mentioned, the 1916 book, what I just described over here, that is section 9 of his book, The Relativity of Simultaneity. After that, he has a section 10 on the relativity of the concept of distance. So if two observers disagree about time, then they also disagree about distance, we shall see. It's a consequence. So in order to be able to tackle those questions, we first need to define distance operationally. So in fact, because it's a bit subtle, because it's distance according to the guy inside the ship and distance according to the guy outside, how are you supposed to kind of translate or switch perspectives about that? It's going to turn out to be some subtleties involved. Let's see how Einstein addresses this issue. So in order to, well, I think it's best to switch images here, you know, let's not go with people playing tennis on the ship anymore. Instead, we are going to go with Einstein's imagery, which is lightning hitting a train. Well, that's his preferred image for that. I think the stuff with the people playing tennis inside a ship, it's a good place to start. It's a good picture in some respects. It's better than the train for some purposes, I think. But certainly the idea of the motion of the ship is undetectable from inside the room. That is quite intuitive in the case of a very large ship, or some cruise ship going at a perfectly steady speed. You won't know the motion when you're deep inside the ship. That makes sense. And more intuitive than in the case of a train. It's not so obvious that you can't tell if a train is moving. I mean, you see my point. And furthermore, the thing with the tennis court, it was also very nice that it has the midpoint was landmarked right in the middle with the net of the tennis as a naturally marked midpoint. So that helped us. Because the midpoint played a prominent role in Einstein's definition of simultaneity. So by having the net there as a kind of vivid image made that more clear, I think. But anyway, so we can go for this more abstract train situation. We don't have that anymore. But so nevertheless, the train, the thing with the tennis stuff, it's not so good because it starts to break down at a certain point, and already in the discussion that I just gave, it's already starting to become problematic, because when we try to explain the simultaneity of the experiment from the point of view of the guy on the shore, then we ran into, you know, the whole tennis thing became not a natural fit anymore, because the guy on the shore, he was supposed to select the midpoint between the two tennis players that was stationary with respect to the shore. But that's not really very practical. How would you do that? You know, hold the point fixed, keep your mirrors there that you need, the two mirrors that are part of Einstein's definition of simultaneity, so that you can look in two directions. Well, that would be very difficult to carry out if, you know, practically, if you have to cut a hole in a ship and have some kind of crane reaching in there and holding a point fixed or something, it's crazy, it doesn't work. In fact, it's even worse than that, you know, because how would the guy even determine the midpoint in the first place? You know, there's a problem enough that to hold the midpoint fixed once you found it, but how is he going to find the point to start with? That itself is a big problem. I said, oh, look, you can find a midpoint using, for example, Euclid already set out to find midpoints. You know, that's trivial. Yeah, okay, fine. That works for the observer on the ship. You know, he can do Euclid's thing with the compasses or whatever, or just use a measuring tape and divide by two. You know, it's fine. But either way, anyway, it doesn't work for the guy on the shore, though. He has to measure two moving targets at the same time, and he has to find the midpoint. How is he supposed to do that? You know, you start putting a measuring tape in one end, and by the time you get to the other end, everything has already moved, so you can't do anything. So very difficult. So the guy on the shore, in order to fix the midpoint, he has to fix the two positions, take the midpoint of two locations at one instant of time. But that's the whole point, isn't it? He doesn't know yet what the same instant is for each point. That's what the experiment with mirrors placed at the midpoint is supposed to reveal, whether or not these things are instantaneous. And yet he has to fix the points at the same instant, but you're doing that in order to check for whether or not the things happen at the same instant or not. So yeah, it becomes very complicated from that point of view, and sort of circular reasoning involved there. So the ship thing, well, that makes that whole ship story kind of very impractical, impossible to make sense of that from the point of view of the outside observer. So we can fix those problems if we switch to the train scenario, Einstein's train scenario, so very well, here we go with the train. A train is traveling at constant speed, and it is struck by lightning in two places. And the question is, did these two lightning strikes occur at the same time or not? Well, we know how to check that now. We have just learned about that. The lightning strikes occurred at the same time if the light from both those events reaches the midpoint between them at the same instant. So in order to check that, you would have to somehow have the double mirrors already set up at the midpoint to begin with as the lightning struck. And so you would have to know in advance where the lightning was going to strike in order for that to work. But, well, whatever, that's just a practical, but it's also quite doable, isn't it? Maybe the train has two lightning rods that guide the lightning to strike in two specific spots. So you can already know in advance where the lightning rods are and where the midpoint needs to be, how to put the mirrors there, and then you can use that to do Einstein's experiment and check for simultaneity. Or whatever, we can simplify it further. You know, we don't really need a train. You can take away the walls of the train, the roof of the train. Let's say the train is just a moving a flatbed car. It's just a floor, and it has one lightning rod at either end. And also it has a pair of mirrors set up exactly halfway between them at the midpoint so that you can see both ends at the same time. And that's how you can be able to judge whether or not the light signals from both events coincide in time or not when they appear in the mirror. So furthermore, it doesn't have to be lightning. You know, you don't have to do this whole thing with lightning rods and so on. You can just replace that with a man-made thing like a light bulb or an explosion or something. Lightning is a pretty good image in some ways. It conveys the idea that it is a light that is the important thing. A lightning rod is kind of pure. The lightning strike is pure light, as it were, so that's nice. And also it conveys the importance of the events happening at one particular instant. So it's not an ongoing thing, like you switch on a light bulb and it just stays on. You know, it's not supposed to be like that. For we have to think of it as a bam, split second done, you know, and therefore the lightning fits that description. And here's another great thing about lightning that will help us a lot. It leaves a mark on the ground, a kind of burn mark, an imprint where the lightning struck. And we don't really need that on the train itself because we already have the lightning rods or whatever marking those positions. So, however, what about the positions of the lightning strikes as seen from the stationary outsider? Now, that gave us quite a bit of trouble with the ship example. You know, the guy on the shore was supposed to reference things to a stationary reference frame from his point of view, but it was very hard for him to make that concrete in that case. You know, how do you freeze certain positions on a moving tennis court in space? You can't. So we could only imagine that theoretically. Here, we're in a better position now with the lightning marks. The train is passing a stationary train platform, let's say, a train station indeed, right? Stationary. And when lightning strikes, it leaves a kind of burn mark with a certain impact radius, so it kind of burns the platform next to the lightning rod on the train, so it leaves a burn mark on the train itself as well as on the platform that it's passing by, let's say. And that's perfect. That's exactly what we need. Now, when we have the positions where the events took place, they are burn marked into the stationary platform itself. So now there's no problem anymore to talk about the midpoint where the two events occurred with respect to the stationary reference frame. So it's just the midpoint between the two burn marks. So we don't have to chase any moving targets anymore to try to pin that point down. So, great. And like we said before, the two observers are going to disagree about whether lightning strikes were simultaneous or not. And we can quote Einstein's explanation of this, just the same thing as I just said about the ship, you know, but here it is expressed in terms of the train and the lightning. Why not read his explanation? I quote him here. When we say that the lightning strikes A and B are simultaneous with respect to the platform, we mean the rays of light emitted at the places A and B, where the lightning occurs, meet each other at the midpoint M of the length AB of the platform. But the events A and B also correspond to positions A and B on the train. Let M prime be the midpoint of the distance AB on the traveling train. When the flashes of lightning occur, this point M prime naturally coincides with the point M on the platform, but the point M prime is moving. with the velocity v of the train. If an observer sitting in the position m prime in the train did not possess this velocity, then he would remain permanently at m, and the light rays emitted by the flashes of lightning at A and B would reach him simultaneously. That is, they would meet just where he is situated. Now, in reality, considered with reference to the railway platform, the observer on the train is hastening towards the beam of light coming from B, while he is riding ahead of the light beam coming from A. So B is the forward direction. Yeah? A is the back of the train, B is the front of the train. All right, I continue the quote. Hence, the observer will see the beam of light emitted from B earlier than he will see that emitted from A. Observers who take the railway train as their reference body must therefore come to the conclusion that the lightning flash B took place earlier than the lightning flash A. So we thus arrive at the important result that events which are simultaneous with respect to the platform are not simultaneous with respect to the train, and vice versa, relativity of simultaneity. Every reference body or coordinate system has its own particular time. Unless we are told the reference body to which a statement of time refers, there is no meaning in a statement of the time of an event. So that's the end of the quote. That's from Einstein. Relativity of simultaneity, relativity of time, in other words. So relativity is a consequence of operationalization. The relativity of time is in turn going to turn out to imply the relativity of space, or the relativity of length, as we already said. And now we must show that. So I would like to quote Einstein's words here about how to compare distances across two different reference frames. That's a subtle question. So first, Einstein gives a very operational definition of how distance is defined within one given reference frame, for example, within the train itself. And here's what Einstein says, quote, "Let us consider two particular points on the train traveling along the platform with the velocity v, and inquire as to their distance apart. An observer in the train measures the interval by marking off a measuring rod in a straight line along the floor of the train, as many times as is necessary to take him from one marked point to the other." So the measuring rod is, for example, a meter in length or something. So the number which tells us how often the rod has to be laid down is the required distance. Yeah, that's of course. So it's great to see Einstein crawling around on all fours here, laying down measuring rods. You know, do you recall Euclid in Raphael's fresco, The School of Athens? Euclid was hunched over with his geometry tools, busy on the floor, you know. Here we are going full circle with Einstein. Not only does Einstein have the same hairstyle as Raphael's Euclid, he also has the same philosophy, you know. If you want to understand the geometry of space, you have to get operationalizing tools to the ground. So, all right, that's how you define distance, or how you operationalize distance. How many sticks long is the thing? You know, how many times do I have to put a stick down to cover the whole distance from one end to the other? That number is the length. Half of that number is the midpoint. So now it gets trickier. The guy on the platform, he wants to measure this length also. How are you supposed to do this with the sticks if everything is moving? One stick, two sticks. Oh, crap. Now the train is already long gone. You know, that didn't work. So the solution to this difficulty is to transfer out an kind of imprint of the train, a freeze frame version of the train length imprinted on the platform, which we can then measure in peace and quiet after the train has left, which is kind of what the lightning marks did of sorts. However, the marks would have to be made at exactly the same time, of course, for this to make sense. That's how you copy the train length. Of course, you don't copy it if you make the marks at different moments in time. Well, that's makes everything very complicated, doesn't it? The same time according to whom? Were the lightning strikes simultaneous or not? Well, the different observers disagreed about that. So when we say mark the two points of the platform that are correspond to the two endpoints of the train, we have to be very careful about how we time those two marking events so that they are truly simultaneous in the correct sense. So let's quote Einstein again. Here's how Einstein describes this kind of scenario. Quote, "The following method suggests itself. If we call A prime and B prime the two points on the train whose distance apart is required, then both of these points are moving with the velocity v along the platform. In the first place, we require to determine the points A and B of the platform, which are just being passed by the two points A prime and B prime at a particular time t, judged from the platform. These points A and B of the platform can be determined by applying the definition of time given above. So the, like lightning strikes in the sense of the happening at the same time in the sense of the guy on the platform and so on. So the quote continues, the distance between these points A and B is then measured by repeated application of the measuring rod along the platform. So just measure it with a meter, yardstick, whatever. It is by no means certain that this last measurement will supply us with the same result as the measurements performed by the observer on the train. And therefore, the length of the train as measured from the platform may be different from that obtained by measuring on the train itself. So, that's right, Einstein. That's, yeah, so that's how Einstein puts it. Here, I can elaborate a little bit on his on what Einstein's abstract description there. You can put picture it like this, maybe. At the end, at each of the two ends of the train, you have a guy with a paintbrush. And as the train passes the platform, the two guys, they each reach out and draw a little mark, a brush mark on the platform. And then the length between those two marks, that's the length of the train, right? But, of course, this involves the idea of at the same time again. So if the painters on the train draw the marks at the same time, according to themselves, according to the train time, then the observer standing on the platform, he will go, no, what are you doing? You mistimed it. You know, the guy at the front, he drew his mark later than the guy at the back of the train. So, oh, you ruined everything. You know, so because they disagreed as... And indeed, it is that direction that it is the one at the end. This is what we already saw with the lightning, that if the light rays from the two events reach the midpoint of the train at the same time, then at that moment, the guy standing at the midpoint between the two marks on the platform, he will have already seen the signal from the event at the back of the train and will not yet have seen the signal coming from the front of the train, since both those signals are now at the midpoint of the train, which has moved away from him. So simultaneous, those things that were simultaneous according to train time, that so if the two brush marks are made simultaneously according to the train clock, that means that the event in the front of the train was delayed. He drew his mark too late according to the platform perspective. The observer is stationary on the platform. So indeed, and the faster the train is going, the greater this delay will be, the greater the difference between their estimations of the whether these things are simultaneous or not. So the distance between the two painted marks will be greater for a faster train. That is to say, the distance between the marks that are drawn simultaneously according to train time. So in other words, the length of the train takes up a bigger portion of the platform. So if the train covered 50% of the platform when it was at rest and will cover 80% of the platform when it's swishing by at a large constant speed, according to the observer on the train, that is to say, I'm talking about marks made simultaneously according to his idea of simultaneity. So as far as he's concerned, the train has grown, so to speak, you might say, or actually the platform has shrunk. Of course, that's how he's going to look at it. The guy in the train, he will interpret it that way because in his view, the train is the thing that remains fixed. To him, the train has the same length all the time. You know, it takes him the same amount of effort to walk from one end of the train to the other. It takes it's as many sticks long, you know, the meter stick, he puts it down and counts how many times. It's the same. So the same stick that he used to measure it when it was parked or when it's moving, it's always, he always gets the same answer for the length of the train. So when he's swishing by the platform and he makes two simultaneous marks according to himself, corresponding to his notion of simultaneity, then he thinks he has transferred out the length of the train onto the platform. And he sees that those marks take up a greater proportion of platform than before. He can only conclude then, well, I guess the platform has shrunk, you know, since the last time I was here. That's the only explanation as far as he's concerned. So that is the famous length contraction phenomena then, that things that move shrink, or rather things that move relative to an observer appear to shrink according to that observer. So the train guy thinks that the platform has shrunk. Also the platform guy thinks that the train has shrunk. We didn't see that directly because the way we set it up, this experiment over here, but it must be that way because the roles of the platform and the train are interchangeable. You know, the guy on the train can say, I'm not moving, you're moving. And there's no physical experiment that can prove him wrong, you know. This is an axiom of relativity theory, this principle that these are interchangeable equivalent observers. Or, yeah. no one of these observational perspectives is privileged over the other. So therefore, if one guy thinks that the other one has shrunk, then the second one must think that the first one has shrunk, you know, because there cannot be any asymmetry there as long as they're moving at constant relative speeds. But we're very well, look, enough physics already, you know, we're not going to become a physics podcast over here. My point was not to do an intro lecture on special relativity. My point was to emphasize how operational the theory of relativity is. Time is something you do. Just as a triangle is something you do in classical geometry, you know. I put a ruler on a piece of paper, I draw three intersecting lines, bam, 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 that's a triangle. There can't be a triangle, it's not perfect, you know. It must have a line without breadth, and it must be perfectly straight. A perfect triangle, it has to be platonic, blah, 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 and not physical. No, you haven't learned a lesson in relativity theory. This is what we can conclude from the story of Einstein. Indeed, Einstein didn't use operational definitions of time and distance because he wanted his theory to be applicable in practice. You know, he was not practice-oriented. He defined everything in terms of doing because the so-called more theoretical alternative was philosophically naive and untenable, the perspective of Newton. That leads to contradictions. You can't make it all work, you know. For the same reason, the Greeks reasoned in terms of constructions, not because they were practically oriented, because they were childlike, like to play around with tools and pre-theoretical, and they try to do something more concrete, something more application-oriented. No, none of those things. The Greeks did constructions precisely because they were more theoretically sophisticated, not less. Just as Einstein's mirrors and sticks are more foundationally sophisticated than the precious abstract theory of Newton. So that was the point that I wanted to make today. Thank you.